would.
The What a Cartoon Show! Now you can see three Cartoon Network originals in one show! A triple dip and power half hour of contemporary cartoon craftings from us to you! On the What a Cartoon Show, tonight at 6 on the World Cartoon Headquarters, Cartoon Network!
Welcome to Checkered Childhood, a classic Cartoon Network podcast covering many, many years of Cartoon Network's history.
I'm Funky. I'm Fresh.
Hi, the Powerpuff Girls.
Not now, boy. I'm busy. Tonight's the third night.
Greetings, Toonheads. I'm your animation aficionado, B-Dubs, and this is Checkered Childhood, a classic Cartoon Network podcast dedicated to all things animation from the 1990s to the early 2000s. In honor of this episode's topic turning 30 this year, we're kicking it old school this time with one of the most bizarre, fun, and wild shows Cartoon Network has ever invented. I'm talking, of course, about the What a Cartoon Show.
What? Cartoon!
Comedy variety anthology of independent animated shorts produced by Hanna-Barbera Studios under the direction of TV media innovator Fred Seibert. In the case the name doesn't sound familiar, let me ring a bell for you. If you've ever seen Oh Yeah cartoons on Nickelodeon in the late 90s to early 2000s, anything marked by the Channel Frederator production company at the end, or are old enough to have witnessed the appearance of the I Want My MTV campaign in the 80s, that's him who made him. Yeah, he is a pretty big deal, but more on him later. For now, let's back up a bit to examine how this show of many different names and tunes got started. Origins. The What a Cartoon Show boasted animation with attitude needed to glue kids to the TV in an era where the Checkered Channel Cartoon Network was still finding its footing, while Nickelodeon's Nicktoons were skyrocketing to success. If you remember from the previous episode of this podcast, Cartoon Network already got off to a steady start repackaging Ted Turner's massive cartoon library, thanks to the creative minds of Betty Cohen and Mike Lazo tossing their ideas against the backboard to see what sticks. Now, with 2+ million viewers and rising, mostly boomers, the channel has begun more comfortable taking risks by repackaging and creating programming blocks for all those cartoons. I think I'll dedicate an episode to the years 1993, 1994, and 1995 to Cartoon Network's history as this podcast matures. But for now, I'll just mention that Lazo creating Space Ghost Coast to Coast sparked interest in CN execs to make more original content rather than simply play it safe, recycling what they currently have. I mean, the Flintstones may be the bedrock of Ted Turner's latest TV experiment, along with the Jetsons, Scooby-Doo, and other Hanna-Barbera icons, but this show was the dirt and grass above it so that the powerhouse era we all know and love could build its home on top in just a couple years later. Actually, despite the variety of nostalgic goodness aimed at baby boomers, Hanna-Barbera as a production company showed signs of waning. Their work was becoming stale and needed a new way to connect with their kid-centered audience, because by the end of the 80s and beginning of the early 90s, most of their content consisted of Scooby-Doo spinoffs and slapping the word kids onto their most popular properties. I'm looking at you, Flintstones and Tom and Jerry. Heck, even Scooby-Doo double-dipped and made a pup named Scooby-Doo. Look, I mean, there's nothing wrong taking an existing idea and tweaking it a little bit in an effort to bring something novel to an audience already familiar with that source material, but to make a cartoon from scratch, to be placed on the pulse of pop culture as it was emerging, that razor-thin blade of the cutting edge, that is unique and special and deserves recognition. Now that Hanna-Barbera Studios' core audience were all grown up and having kids of their own, they had to find a way to ride this wave of the breakneck, extreme, gross counterculture 90s kids were embracing, or else risk becoming a washed-up animation studio and shutting their doors for good after a good 4-decade run. Enter Fred Seibert, who sported very little experience making cartoons, but had done over 1,000 network IDs across multiple channels. And with experience like that, he had to start somewhere. He started off by dipping his toe into the animation pool by helping produce shows like SWAT Cats the Radical Squadron and even Two Stupid Dogs in 1992. Both shows at the time only lasted for 2 seasons, sadly, and they were met with mixed lukewarm praise, though I have noticed that both have grown cult followings in the years and decades since. Meanwhile, William Hanna and Joseph Barbera remain skeptical of what the young upstart could do to revitalize their company on the decline. But Fred nonetheless was confident in a plan so crazy that it just might work. Picture this. Instead of the studio using pre-existing talent to make new cartoons, why not have the talent simply come to them? It was an auteur's paradise, an opportunity for indie, underground, and fresh college graduates to cut their teeth by doing what they spent their whole lives dreaming about. When developing this plan, Fred Seibert stated how networks were more concerned with offering new programs over the quality of those programs. And since cartoons were on the decline after the end of the 80s, they needed something fresh. To do this, he would get the word out to hand select up to 48 applicants to produce their show. Once Cartoon Network execs met with Fred and his team's seal of approval, the creator of those cartoons would immediately jump to the drawing board to work on their pilots, which were purely creator-driven efforts without executive interference, a strategy quite in vogue in the early 90s of TV. I mean, just look at Nickelodeon. It worked for them with their Nicktoons, and, you know, they just had to take it and run and see if the formula worked for their channel, too. The whole effort to make an anthology show of original pilots screened with ambition and risk, costing nearly twice as much as a regular original series to produce. But as it's often said in life, with great risk comes great reward. So Fred knew he was onto something great. During this spark period of the show, Fred often sought advice from Ren Stimpy creator John Chris Felucci, who had also shared a mutual love of Looney Tunes with Siebert and helped produce Two Stupid Dogs with Donovan Cook as director. Fred was in good company with people who were excited to make something totally new happen. As early as 1993 and late into 1995, animated short pitches flooded into Hanna-Barbera studios from everywhere imaginable. A whopping 5,000 pitches were collected. And suddenly, the task to narrow down the bunch to just 48 became a daunting, nigh impossible task, even with a seasoned team of executives in the background shunning the effort, convinced that his idea would fail. However, they persevered, and they launched the show with the world premiere Toons Tune-In on February 20th, 1995.
Are you ready for the debut of world premiere Toons? Have you marked off your calendar for Monday night? Have you set your VCR and told everyone that a brand new star is about to be born? The curtain is going up on the very first world premiere Toon, Monday night at 8 on the Cartoon Network!
Speaking of teamwork, Fred's crew consisted of a melting pot of fresh and seasoned animators alike, ranging from age 20 years to 70 years. It was unlike any situation in the industry at the time because you were taking, you know, a little bit of everything to see what would stick. Some of the animators include John R. Dilworth, Rob Renzetti, Craig McCracken, Gandhi Tartakovsky, Van Partible, Butch Hartman, Bruno Bozzetto, and Hanna-Barbera storyboard artist Jerry Eisenberg. And let's not forget the adult animation pioneer Ralph Bakshi, and even William Hanna and Joseph Barbera themselves, who felt the need to be a part of this as a last-ditch effort to save their company. When collaborating on the shorts with everyone in the talent pool, Fred had this to say regarding the whole development process. On top of research and development program, I reinvigorated the who comes in the studio equation. Now talented people wanted to show up. Some 5,000 people pitched us cartoons from all over the world. We got into business with Ralph Bakshi, with Bruno Bozzetto. We got into business with a broad range of people who never had given Hanna-Barbera a passing chance. We worked with people who were 70 years old, who were 20 years old. We turned on its head the perception of people in the community had of us. So, okay, the Toons were now being made with a big healthy budget of $10 million, thanks to Ted Turner's support, and no standards and practices telling them what not to do. But what about the advertising? What about the funding? How would people know when, where, and what to tune into on TV? The internet at the time was barely creeping into home computers, so they had to be clever. When asked about the marketing campaign about What a Cartoon, Fred Seibert turned to artist Frank Kozik for inspiration. His bright, colorfully fluorescent stylized posters did help bring alternative rock of the 1980s and early 90s into mainstream media. So he replicated that formula by creating posters of his own for each of the What a Cartoon shorts, with the hopes that it gained attention of people who were into fresh new content, whether it be cartoons or music. Thanks to the help of creative director Bill Burnett and senior art director Jesse Stagg, they made these posters become a reality as a part of their guerrilla ad campaign. So they ended up mailing them, along with stickers, flyers, and even magazine ads, to every major animation giant in the media at the time. And even some consumers, too. But wait, hold the phone. World premiere tunes, you said? I thought we were talking about the What a Cartoon Show. Well, we are, but it goes by slightly different names depending on who you ask and what part of its history we're covering. You see, the world premiere of TuneIn is an event that was led by Space Ghost, marking the series' metaphorical grand opening ribbon-cutting ceremony. So they had that event to showcase the cartoons, and then once that aired, a week later, they actually did the What a Cartoon Show, which is titled What a Cartoon, but it doesn't have the and the show in it, unless you look at later bumpers. It's a little bit confusing, I know, but all three names are interchangeable. It doesn't really matter as long as you know what the content is. So the anticipation is now over. The tunes are premiere, and now we have What a Cartoon, evolved from World Premiere Tunes as a marketing campaign, essentially. Once it became a mainstay on Cartoon Network, they softened the title a bit, and it even morphed into the Cartoon Show later on, post-Powerhouse era, to conform with the whole Cartoons movement taking over channel. And that's around the time there was a second wind of cartoons that got picked up the series, much like the first wave with What a Cartoon Show. You had Billy and Mandy, Grim and Evil, Whatever Happened to Robot Jones, Sheep in the Big City, Mike Lou and Og, Kids Next Door, of course. So this was a formula that was very tight and true and was tried at a couple attempts during the channel's history to get fresh content, because it worked through this way. It worked in 1995 when this show premiered. I would say the biggest contributors of the effort were Genndy Tartakovsky, who made Dexter's Lab pilots, two of them, Craig McCracken, who also did two pilots for the Powerpuff Girls, Rob Winzetti, who did Mina and the Count and would later go on to work on My Life as a Teenage Robot, John R. Dilworth, who of course did Courage the Cowardly Dog, and Ace and Avery, which was on Big Bag on Cartoon Network, Seth MacFarlane, who used his proof of concept of Larry and Steve to create Family Guy, and Butch Hartman, who is responsible for The Fairly Odd Parents, Tough Puppy, Danny Phantom on Nickelodeon, of all places, and several related properties. So now that the 48 animated shorts were all packaged together neatly, tightly on an anthology show, Fred Seibert left the project and chose to step down as president of Hanna-Barbera Studios in 1996, after the studio was included in a deal to sell to Turner Broadcasting and Time Warner Media. He felt his time was done, and he did everything he wanted to do in this lightning-in-a-bottle moment of Cartoon Network history. So he went on to make Frederator Studios from there to support independent animation, and in a similar vein, also created other anthology shows over on Nickelodeon, such as Oh Yeah Cartoons in 1999 and Random Cartoons shortly after. But I think that's enough origin story of how What a Cartoon Show came to be. Let's look under the hood of this cartoon hot rod to see a little bit more, including show info and notable pilots that the series has to offer.
It's an odyssey of inventive Cartoon Network products.
What?
It's three choice cartoons.
What?
The What a Cartoon Show.
So, What Cartoon, or World Premiere Tunes, or the Cartoon Show, or The What Cartoon Show, depending on what you prefer. It's all the same thing. It was created by Fred Seibert, and the theme music that we all know and love with that rockin' alternative rock edgy intro, that was Gary Lionelli, who'd be used for many other independent animated efforts at the time. The format is 16 total episodes, consisting of 48 animated shorts across the series. Each episode were about 7 minutes in runtime, so that totaled 21 minutes for an episode, plus commercials. And the air dates were February 20th, 1995 for the world premiere tune-in with Space Ghost, and February 26th, 1995 as the official start to the series. It lasted until November 28th, 1997, before being rebooted as the Cartoon Show in 2000. And so, some notable pilots among the 48. I handpicked a few of these that stood out to me. You may have different picks, that's quite all right, but this is just like a sampler plate of what a cartoon show has to offer. Starting off, we have Powerpuff Girls with Meet Fuzzy Lumpkins, which was, believe it or not, the very first aired What a Cartoon short of the very first episode. And the premise is pretty simple, although a bit insane. And what happens is Fuzzy Lumpkins enters a jam contest with his meat-based jam, very ahead of its time because we now have bacon jam, or at least that was a thing in the 2010s. And feeling the shame and humiliation of losing that contest, Fuzzy Lumpkins retaliates by essentially zapping everyone in his path in the city of Townsville into various meat products with his ray gun. What I like about this one is that the energy exponentially ramps up once he hits Bubbles' hair, turning into a drumstick. And the action is just, ooh, it really packs a punch. And it's unlike anything you've ever seen in a kid's show. So I can see why Powerpuff Girls got picked up for series after this one aired. But to pair with it, there was a second pilot that came after called Crime 101. And it features Powerpuff Girls helping probably the lamest villains you've ever seen in their show's universe, the Amoeba Boys, helping them commit a crime so that they can get thrown in jail and be considered legitimate villains. Of course, they're incompetent, a kind of timid. The girls do help them rob a bank, although they did most of the work. And once they got thrown in jail, the day was quote-unquote saved by these fairly harmless blobs of cellular substance. It's definitely not as strong as the Meet Fuzzy Lumpkins one, but it's still worth checking out. It's got some charm to it, although a lot less action. Moving on with another two pilots, we have Dexter's Lab. The first one, Changes, is the official name for it because that's what the independent short was titled when Genndy Tartakovsky made it for CalArts. But it was adapted into this What a Cartoon short and simply had Dexter's Lab name slapped on it. What happens in it is when Dee Dee checks on Dexter to see if he's ready to go to school, she discovers his latest invention, which is like a remote that changes whoever is facing it into a random animal. And they fight over it and they turn into many different animals while trying to get ready for school. And of course, hilarity ensues. And eventually they turn back into their original forms, but not the way that you expect. I think this is a very funny short, and I'm glad that Dexter got picked up the series based on this premiering. I'd say of all the animals that I've seen them become, the T-Rex and Beaver are my favorite because when they're brushing their teeth, it's like, oh, you never really think about how these animals would brush their teeth if they're thrown into a situation where they would have to. The other Dexter's Lab pilot is The Big Sister. And once Dee Dee eats an experimental cookie in Dexter's lab, it causes her to grow to a ginormous size. We're talking like Goldar, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers size here, so that she's looming over the city and picking up random civilians and playing dollies with them, which is pretty funny in its own right. But Dexter has to bring her back home and bring her back down to size for the mishap that he inadvertently caused. So he gets his Robodexo 2000 Mecha, the first appearance of that would later be reused in other episodes of Dexter's Lab series. And they confront each other with some, let's say, playful violence. We'll call it that. It's a fun short overall with a jumbo-sized plot. Fun twist ending, of course, with the mom getting involved. And it reminds me a lot of the film Honey, I Blew Up the Kid, which was from the early 90s. Yeah, check it out. It's a barrel of laughs. But moving on to another popular dame at the time that was a series in the Powerhouse era, there's Johnny Bravo, and they also had two pilots. The first one is self-titled and involves Johnny Bravo trying to pick up a female zookeeper while she captures a gorilla that escaped from the zoo, bring him back. The gorilla is fairly large and fuchsia in color for some reason. And he's wearing a pretty pathetic disguise, just like a tiny wig on his head. And Johnny Bravo can't see through it to see that's him. And inadvertently saves the day by returning the gorilla to his owner, but somehow getting stiffed of a date because Johnny Bravo is kind of a creepy, jerky kind of person. But he thinks it's okay because he's pretending to be Elvis Presley. I don't know. It's a weird pilot. I do remember it, though, for its humor. I would say the better one is the second one, which is Johnny Bravo and the Amazon Women, where he ends up washing up ashore on a deserted island from a whale-watching boat. Of course, he runs into large Amazon women who are native to the island, and they see him as like a tiny threat who they don't be bothered by. So they summon their giant purple elephant, Christopher, which is actually based off of the Banana Splits elephant. I forgot what was his name, but that was also a Hanna-Barbera, I guess, TV project from yesteryear in the 60s. And so the elephant interacts with Johnny Bravo, steals his underwear, squashes him a few times, and gets rid of him so that the Amazon women can go about living their lives. It's pretty fun seeing the hijinks. It's not too overtly like cringy pickup line stuff that he's known for. But the twist ending is pretty fun because it turns the whole equation of running into people you want to be around on its head. Moving on, we have just one pilot from Cow and Chicken, even though they got picked up to series in the Powerhouse era. And it's called No Smoking. This one really stood out to me when it first came out because of the ending. It was a bit unnerving, involving mom and dad. I'm not going to spoil it for you. You just have to watch it for yourself. But it really made me think about smoking and not to do it as intended by the creator, David Feiss, even though some CN execs tried to ban this episode, saying it promoted smoking and was like using negative Christian imagery with the devil. But I don't know what they were really thinking because it was meant to be lighthearted yet edgy. Anyways, the basic premise of the short involves Chicken resisting Cow's request to play with him, and he finds himself at the mercy of the devil after he's tempted with cigarettes to smoke because Cow found cigarettes in his underwear drawer, and Chicken tries to deny it, but when he's led into temptation into hell by the cigarettes and feels the torture of smoking a massive cigarette, he realizes he needs some help to get out of there, and of course it's up to Cow's alter ego Super Cow to come save him so that they can battle the devil / the red guy and his one-time accomplice Cerberus so that everything can go back to normal. It's a very fun pilot, and more of the humor and style, animation style you see here would continue on in the series. So if you're into Cow and Chicken, Rocko's Modern Life, Ren Stimpy, anything in that like edgy, goofy, animal-based animation style that's prominent in the 90s, you'll like this. Lastly, of the main shorts pilots that got picked up for series, we have Courage Cowardly Dog with the Chicken from Outer Space. And this one's a little bit different because it originally was in an animation festival circuit before being submitted to What a Cartoon Show. And it ended up even being nominated for an Oscar too, which goes to show the quality of visual storytelling and amazing pacing that this horror mixed with humor short provides. Pretty unnerving art style and premise. I mean, you got this chicken from outer space coming down in a flying saucer that's CGI that looks like an egg, and he's going to terrorize this little dirt farm in the middle of nowhere. And this little pink dog, who is Courage, of course, he doesn't really say much in this episode, nor does Eustace or Muriel. But I think if you're familiar with Courage's Cowardly Dog, you know the drill. Courage faces the chicken, tries to protect his human owners from being zapped by them. Eustace ends up eating one of the weird red spotted eggs and turning into a chicken himself and going crazy, while Muriel tries to defend herself. And of course, Courage battles the chicken in an arm wrestling match, in chess, and holding his breath, among many other things, to get him to lose and go back home. But when the chicken doesn't play fair, he tries to zap him with his space ray gun, but that backfires. And somehow the day saved and everything's back to normal, even though Eustace also got vaporized by the ray gun as a chicken. But that doesn't matter too much. The point is, this was a great pilot that continued all of its beautiful lore and humor and horror in the main series, and it's definitely worth checking out whether you've seen it or not. I'm going to mention this one before we go to notable one-offs that I found throughout What a Cartoon Show, because it's kind of skirting the line between a main series staple and then a more obscure pick. This one is Larry and Steve, who I mentioned before, is tied to Family Guy. And that's because it's more of a proof of concept than an official pilot, which we ended up seeing during, I believe, Super Bowl 33 at the beginning of 1999. But this one explores how a dim-witted, just ordinary guy who's middle-aged finds a dog in a dog pound that he understands, that speaks full English. And because he sees his talent and unique abilities, he decides to bring him home to his house. But there isn't much furniture for him there. I mean, the furniture breaks, like the TV and the bed and the lamp. So both of them go to the local mall to replace the furniture. Of course, this isn't any ordinary cartoon. If they just went about shopping like we do, they'd be boring to watch. So a lot of hilarity ensues, including a fork in the road slicing their car in half, him putting like a million watt bulb or something ridiculous into a lamp and creating like this massive lightsaber to cut through everything. And my favorite bit, which is the kid in the pilot in an airplane crashing it into the mall and then just walking away from it as if nothing big happened. That pilot definitely reminds me of Glenn Quagmire too, with his voice and character design. So that's worth noting as well. It's definitely a strong proof of concept that Family Guy built off of. So I'd highly advise you check it out if you happen to see it anywhere online.
You're watching the What a Cartoon Show right here on Cartoon Network.
All right, so those are the main pilots that evolved into something greater beyond the What a Cartoon Show, that is the cartoon incubator that it is. But here are some notable one-offs and even some that made two or three cartoons but didn't really take off as expected. First on the list, Zoonotics, Home Sweet Home. The art style is very similar to Joey Album's Doo-Wop Dinosaur art style that was prevalent in the mid-80s as he was getting his involvement in Nickelodeon, the animation industry. He also worked on graphics for Clarissa Explains It All, Eureka's Castle, Sesame Street, and he even did Nick's Thanksgiving Fest too, which is a Thanksgiving special, 1989. But enough about Nickelodeon. You know, it's three animals who are sick of this circus life because they come from a traveling circus and they want to get into a zoo to live a cushy life in a cage where people feed them every day. And so to try to do that, they break in using various schemes. Most of them don't work, but when they talk to the manager, they eventually get in. It's, I believe, a bear, a monkey, and a turtle, and they all have unique personalities, kind of like the Three Stooges. So if you like Joey Album's art style that you've seen with the Doo-Wop Dinosaur and other like Nickelodeon commercial graphics, I'd check this one out. Moving on, we have Joffin, help, which is the only word that he says in the short. That's why it's worth noting. He's a big blue cat who pricks his finger sewing, and he needs help. But everyone he turns to, who somehow look all the same in the medical office or wherever Joff goes, tries to like overcomplicate things and not actually help him, but just make things worse. And I guess that's what stood out in my brain to me, is that he tries to solve the problem with a simple solution, but it's anything but. You know, despite all that, he's able to go back home and sew again. But of course, we have a bookend to the beginning at the end that's very similar, but he handles it differently. And I'm glad that this short exists, because it's very wholesome, but it's also got a good dose of cartoon craziness that is prevalent in many of these shorts. Next up, we have Yucky Duck in Short Orders. One of many animated shorts created by Pat Ventura, who also did Sledgehammer Opossum Series 2 on this anthology show. Not to go too much into detail, there's not much plot here. Yucky Duck fails to serve guests at a fine dining restaurant. He gets complaints about not giving them the right food. Characters look very strange. Graphics are very flat. Colors are washed out. It's what you'd expect from him, as you see both Yucky Duck shorts. Help On My Way is the other one, and then both of the Sledgehammer Opossum ones. It's strange animation. Very Tex Avery-like, very geometric, like the 60s UPA flat cartoons, like Gerald McBoing-Boing and Mr. Magoo. But it's something. I mean, if you like that kind of stuff, it's there. Very similar is George and Junior in Look Out Below, which is a reimagining of Tex Avery. It's literally a Tex Avery cartoon, but in a 90s coat of paint. So that has similar humor to that and both Pat Ventura's efforts too. And despite all of his efforts, he didn't really take off. So I'm curious what a Yucky Duck or Sledgehammer Opossum series would look like if it went further. Moving on, we have Pizza Boy in No Tip. And this one stood out to me because it's kind of a snapshot of mental health when work really drains you bone dry with its high expectations, its demands, and extreme requests. This poor teenager works for his father in a pizza parlor, and he has to deliver a pizza to the South Pole, to an Eskimo couple, within 5 minutes or less. I mean, come on. How is that possible? Except in a cartoon, of course. But his big incentive is he wants a big tip for doing that. But he doesn't know how much he's going to get. And I'd say, you know, if this is real life, don't do it, man. That's not worth all the effort that you had to go through. I mean, he essentially went insane by the end and got thrown in jail, spoiler alert. But it really gives you room to reflect on how work can affect your state of mind when you see an exaggerated example of it in a cartoon. So if anything, this has aged pretty well to today's standards, even if it has a similar cartoon style as, say, like Yucky Duck on What a Cartoon Show, but with more color and personality, I'd say. Moving on, we have Malcolm and Melvin. Babe, He Calls Me. And I don't remember too much about this one other than Melvin. Melvin is like a bug or a flea or something, and he helps Malcolm pretend to play trumpet for some reason, and his mom is like dressing like Jessica Rabbit, and there's this random superhero with a blue mask and a red long underwear outfit. It's weird. I mean, if you're familiar and even like Ralph Bakshi's animation body of work, you know what you're getting into, but for everyone else, it's a bit strange. You don't know what to make of it. I'm mentioning it here because this is one of his animation efforts of the 90s. I mean, before this, he did Fritz the Cat and Wizards in decades prior. So it's a good example of if he's able to keep up with the times, though he's past his prime as a 70-something-year-old animator. Next up, we have Strange Things. Not to be confused with Stranger Things, which is very anticipated for its final season. Strange Things is the only 3D short that ever appeared on the What a Cartoon Show. And that's why I had to make note of it. It's got a very unusual animation style that it's fluid, but it's not fluid at the same time. Like, not fluid to today's 3D animated standards. But it's reminiscent of shows like Beast Wars or even Reboot, which were definitely mainstays of the mid-90s for children's CGI entertainment. I would say it's even more akin to like the Pixar shorts before they did Toy Story. It's a little bit clunky, but still fun to watch as like a milestone of how CGI evolved as a medium within animation. It also features the same female computer voice as the one in Dexter's Lab and Ratchet & Clank video game series. So I wanted to note that if you've watched that series or played that video game. The only thing I remember about it is that it's like a little crash dummy painted like sweeper bot. And he's like talking with the security card bot, make sure he doesn't touch anything while he's cleaning things. And he knocks a bunch of stuff over. And this thing affects that thing in a Rube Goldberg type machine, and chaos ensues. And he has to somehow get it back to normal by the time the guard checks on him again. And then by the end of it, somehow he pushes a button that he's not supposed to push. And there's a giant missile that shows up and is aimed right at the guard. So make of it what you will. It's quirky, weird, but fun. We only have two more on the list, so don't worry, I'm not going through all 48. That's for you to do on your own free time. But we have Blues Gang in Bow Wow Buccaneers. And I would say this is my personal favorite among among the animal-oriented cartoons in What a Cartoon Show that only got one short. It's very similar to Edda and Eddy, but with dogs. It's got a little bit of Too Stupid Dog humor in it, too. And essentially, these three dogs come together at night when their owners are asleep, and they pretend to play pirates in the street with their own little pirate ship. It's a lot of fun. I love it. It's cute. It's charming. It's a little bit crazy, but well-rounded as an animated short. It was created by Mike Milo and his team, who also did the Ignoramuses shorts on the show, too. So it's nice to see that there's some overlap with these creators helping each other out in this endeavor to just have any of them get picked up for series years later. And last but not least, we have Hard Luck Duck, which was Hanna-Barbera's own shot at making a modern edgy cartoon. Spoiler, it is pretty wholesome, but also forgettable. But it is worth noting that they too, you know, William Hanna and Joseph Barbera made their own cartoons. Just so they say they were a part of it in their sunset years of the studios before they changed hands. I would say, actually, Dino and Stay Out is a stronger offering by Hanna-Barbera because they know Flintstones and they know Dino. So they're able to allow Dino's personality to shine in that situation where he's like constantly fighting the Bobcat or whoever other character is trying to keep him out of Fred Flintstone's house at night. And I like how the focus is put on him because normally we focus on Fred Flintstone and family in the classic Hanna-Barbera cartoons, but yet this still feels fresh, even if it's just slightly more refined looking animation style wise than the original 60s cartoons. Both are worth checking out. Woo, that's a lot of cartoons that we covered. But just before we go, I'm going to share some memories of what I had of What a Cartoon Show growing up. I love watching the show. I mean, I used to watch it at my grandma's place whenever she babysat me and immediately turned to it once I was hooked. I remember sending away for like a magazine ad of World Premiere Toons to get some of the stickers. And I don't think I got all the stickers, but I definitely got a Dexter's Lab one that I remember slapping on this like glass pane of my TV cabinet where my PlayStation 1 was underneath my TV. And that constantly reminded me to tune into Dexter's Lab, and just seeing the early style of it before the series got picked up a couple years later. It's fun to reminisce about. And it goes to show how I was influenced into watching Dexter's Lab just because I saw that sticker every time I watched TV. Yeah, I also remember watching the commercials that were on air too. Dexter was on them, and even Powerpuff Girls. And I saw some of the other ones too, like Kitchen Casanova and Oh Rats. They were exciting and I wanted to know more, so naturally I tuned in. I ended up watching nearly all the shorts, of course, my lifetime, and they're still fun to revisit on occasion. I'm sure we'll revisit What a Cartoon Show again in a different episode format of this podcast so that we can talk more in depth about either the episodes themselves or like favorites of them, etc. So all that being said, why does What a Cartoon Show actually matter? Why should we remember it today when Cartoon Network has long gone from airwaves? Well, I mean, it's worth noting that animation was undergoing an underground renaissance in the early to mid-90s all over kids' TV and even on MTV with Liquid Television and MTV Oddities, of course. Many new emerging channels were eager to stake their claim in TV territory in the 80s and 90s, and they looked to find their own bodies of creator-driven animation to appeal to a wider audience. So naturally, they opened their doors to anyone who would submit a pilot, or two, or three, in some cases, with the hopes that if enough darts were thrown at a board, eventually they hit a bullseye. And of course they did, because we got Johnny Bravo, Cow and Chicken, Powerpuff Girls, Dexter's Lab, Kids Next Door later on, Whatever Happened to Robot Jones, Sheep in the Big City, Mike Lunog. I mean, it was a great incubator for potential to become something real. And I really appreciate that this was allowed to happen, because if What a Cartoon Show never came together, none of these cartoons would exist. Like, think about that. Think about your memories of all these cartoons. And if you didn't have them, how would it make you different or appreciate cartoons in a different way? Would we still be watching old Hanna-Barbera and Tex Avery and Warner Brothers cartoons from Ted Turner's classic cartoon library? Maybe. But sometimes you got to take risks in life to succeed. And Fred Sabert and his team did a phenomenal job of doing this for the channel. It helped solidify their identity beyond the foundation that they acquired through the purchase when Cartoon Network started. So with all that being said, where can you watch the What a Cartoon shorts now? Well, your best bet's YouTube. I've seen many playlists and even a channel dedicated to What a Cartoon shorts. So if you do some quick searching, you can find some there and see what you can enjoy for yourself. I don't believe all of the shorts are there, but at least 33 of the 48 are from what I've gathered. So if you're still looking for more, try find some people who have them already, way, shape, or form, where it's like a VHS tape, CD, copy, you name it, digital copy. They might even be on some of the older TV DVD box sets from like Dexter, Johnny Bravo, Powerpuff Girls, Courage Cowardly Dog, because I think that's where I saw the Dexter and Johnny Bravo ones. But I do want to note that as of the day of this recording, Max has pulled all of its cartoon catalog from its streaming service, so you're kind of out of luck there, even though they used to have Cartoon Network stuff. If you'd like to learn more about the What a Cartoon history or Fred Sabert and his involvement with creating it, you can check out the Vulture article that I referenced, What a Cartoon Remembered. You can also go to his Channel Frederick website to see the World Premiere Tunes page that is dedicated to the show. You can also go to Van Parble's website, which covers high-quality photos of World Premiere Tunes promo merch, including the stickers that I had mentioned. And, of course, there's the Dot and Line interview that I consulted with Fred Sabert to go a little bit deeper into detail. All right, cartoon lovers, I think we're going to close up shop for today. But before we go, let me ask you this. Which What a Cartoon short was most memorable for you? Was it one of the mainstay ones, or was it a more obscure one? Did you have ones that you absolutely hated, absolutely loved, feel indifferent towards? Whatever your thoughts are, just email me at checkerchildhood@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. I am working on getting a YouTube channel up for these episodes, but that's going to take some time since this is a one-man show at the moment. But once that's up, you're welcome to share your comments there too. But for now, just email me. I'd love to hear from you. And if you're feeling generous and enjoy this podcast that I'm growing so far, help me out by giving me some ratings and reviews so that I can be lifted up into more podcast platforms and share my vast animation history with other cartoon lovers in the world. I'd say that's all the tunage I can handle for today. That is a very big topic and gives me an idea for what to cover and what not to cover in future retrospectives for other Cartoon Network shows. Yeah. All right, check in with us next time in episode 3 to find out what we'll cover next. I don't think I want to reveal quite what we're going to cover, but I think the magic is in the mystery, so you just have to listen to episode 3 to find out for sure. Till then, keep the spirit of Cartoon Network alive in the memories of your heart and the movies of your mind, because without you, the animation of our youth would cease to exist. Sayonara, my rude, crude, what a cartoon dudes with attitude. Dudettes too. Later.
Join us next time for
Three Cartoons,
the What a Cartoon Show.